All right. Well, it's said that a rich American businessman was vacationing in Mexico, but he was disturbed to find a fisherman just sitting lazily by his boat. He asked, why aren't you out there fishing? Well, because I've caught enough fish for today, was the answer. Well, why don't you catch more fish than you need? What would I do with them? Well, you could earn more money, came the impatient reply. He said, well, you could buy a better boat so you could go out farther and deeper and catch more fish. You could purchase better nets. You could catch even more fish and make more money. And soon you'd have a fleet of boats as I do, just like me. Well, then what would I do? Well, you could sit down and enjoy life, said the industrialist. The fisherman looked at him and says, what do you think I'm doing right now? In light of the title of this message, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Misery, I want to begin by asking some very simple questions with sometimes very difficult answers. Are you happy? Number one, are you happy? Number two, what is it that will finally make you happy? And number three, when will you finally be happy? Those are important questions, anytime, anywhere, and under any circumstance. What we're looking for, in other words, is the secret to contentment. That is apparently the greatest blessing in life. And that, too, is what King Solomon was looking for. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, he describes his search. And we're actually in a series on through the book of Ecclesiastes right now. Now, Ecclesiastes is a recording of Solomon's search for this peace and contentment, if you will. And two phrases are used throughout the book, and we'll see it every week. One is vanity. Vanity is used over 30 times in the book. It literally, the word hebel means vapor or mist. Everything is a mist. Everything appears to be solid, but it's just not really there. And then he uses the phrase under the sun. And under the sun basically means everything here on earth, under the heavens, under God, just down here from a mortal view, everything under the sun. And so the thesis statement for this whole book is found in the very opening verses, chapter 1, verse 2. Everything is meaningless, says the teacher, completely meaningless. Very encouraging verse there in the scriptures. And everything's meaningless. And he finishes, you would think he'd finish with a positive completion to the whole thing. Chapter 12, verse 8 says the exact same thing. It says everything is meaningless, completely meaningless. So he starts with that idea, he ends with that idea, and everything in between is about that idea. And so a lot of Christians don't like studying that book. It's a downer. It brings me down every time I read this book kind of thing. But in reality, it reminds us that true, everything is meaningless down here below, under the sun. But in the sun, everything is positive. But this is how he puts it bluntly and brutally and desperately, that life is very empty. And much of the book of Ecclesiastes is taken up with what the preacher, that's who he calls himself, the preacher, is showing us ways that people use to try and find an escape route from this meaningless life. Out of the meaningless, out of the emptiness, out of the futility, if you will, that's life apart from God. Last week we looked at chapter 1 of the book. We were introduced to Solomon and learned of his qualifications for this search. He was very rich. He was an observer of human life, and he had plenty of time and plenty of money. We learn that there's nothing in and of itself that can make us content. No thing, no possession, no person, no relationship will continually yield to us the fruit of contentment and happiness and delight. Now he's going to explore the escape route of pleasure, of what's called hedonism. We find three lessons here in his quest. Number one, you cannot quench the thirst of life by drinking in pleasure. It won't serve its purpose. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, the first 11 verses, the passage outlines in five parts. The first part, Solomon describes for you the quest he's going to go on. Verse 1, I said to myself, come on, let's try pleasure. Let's look for the good things in life. And I need to pause here and say that maybe some of us here today are doing that same thing. We're looking for relief from the monotony, the boredom of our life, or from the insubstantial meaning of our life, and we're looking for it in pleasure. Well, if that's where you are today, Solomon knows exactly where you are. He's been there. God knows exactly where you are, and he wrote this book for you. So that the first part in this quest and the second part is the conclusion. You'll see Solomon doing this constantly. He introduces a new quest, and then he gives you immediately the conclusion to the quest. And in this case, the conclusion of his search through pleasure is failure. He continues on in verse 1. Again, let's look for the good things in life. But I found that this, too, was meaningless. You know, today we have many contemporary examples of individuals whose lives were devoted to pleasure. Think of folks like Kurt Cobain or River Phoenix and Elvis Presley, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix. These are individuals who sought pleasure at the extent of everything else, and they all died young, never being fulfilled in that search. It doesn't work. It's all meaningless. It has no use whatsoever. Now, knowing you're probably going to say, well, yes, Solomon, but you probably just didn't do the search right. And so he says, oh, yeah, well, let me tell you how I did it. So the next few verses, verses 2 to 8, he actually catalogs for you the different ways in which he pursued pleasure in his life. It starts out in verse 2. So I said, laughter is silly. What good does it do to seek pleasure? And after much thought, I decided to cheer myself with wine. And while still seeking wisdom, I clutched at foolishness. In this way, I tried to experience the only happiness most people find during their brief life in this world. I also tried to find meaning by building huge homes for myself and by planting beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks and filled them with all kinds of fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water to irrigate my many flourishing groves. I bought slaves, both men and women, and others were born into my household. I also owned large herds and flocks, more than any of the kings who had lived in Jerusalem before me. I collected great sums of silver and gold, the treasure of many kings and provinces. I hired wonderful singers, both men and women, and had many beautiful concubines. I had everything a man could possibly desire. Now, as we look more carefully at this list, first of all, he says wine. Well, we've got a few more products that we could use today to do the same thing. We can do drugs and other things, but it's basically the same thing. He wanted to inebriate himself. He wanted to get drunk. He wanted to remove himself from the realities of life and drown himself in his sorrows. But every night, he tried to do it, and it didn't go. He's going to see that it does not bring satisfaction. You can let your mind fill in the gaps here. Imagine how the palace must have rocked with laughter every night. They had stand-up comedians. They had lavish feasts. Wine was flowing like water. In fact, you may be interested to know what just one day's menu consisted of for Solomon in his palace during this time. 1 Kings records what King Solomon required for one day to feed the royal palace. The daily food requirements for Solomon's palace were 150 bushels of flour, 300 bushels of meal, 10 oxen from the fattening pens, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep or goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roe deer, and choice poultry. That was the menu for just one day in Solomon's palace. It's been estimated that would feed between 10 and 20,000 people, so there were a lot of others involved in this search for pleasure along with King Solomon. Then he mentions the pleasure of products or projects. He built houses for himself. He planted vineyards for himself. He made gardens and parks for himself and fruit trees for himself and ponds for yourself for himself. And did you notice there's a common theme there? Everything was for I and for myself. This guy is not doing this for the grand motive of helping the community. He just comes out and tells you, I did these for me, for my own personal gratification. Many have tried to find meaning in building things. You may have heard of the Winchester Mystery House. It's in San Jose, California. It's a mansion. It was once the personal residence of Sarah Winchester, the widow of the creator of the Winchester rifle. Under Sarah Winchester's day-to-day guidance, the building started in 1884, and it proceeded around the clock, by some accounts, without interruption for the next 38 years, only stopping with her death on September 5th, 1922. This house is a maze of rooms, the doors that open to blank walls, staircases that go to nowhere, all in order to just keep building. There are roughly 160 rooms, 40 bedrooms, 2 ballrooms, 47 fireplaces, over 10,000 panes of glass, 17 chimneys with evidence of probably 2 more, 2 basements and 3 elevators, all without any apparent purpose. Some wealthy people gain a reputation as philanthropists because they endow beautiful public buildings, but they always manage to get their names engraved on a brass plaque somewhere on that building. It was said of the Emperor Nero that he found Rome a city of bricks and he left it a city of marble. But history tells us he didn't do that for the beautification of Rome. He did it for his own gratification and his own fame. According to 1 Kings chapter 7, Solomon's palace included an audience hall, a treasury, the judgment hall where Solomon's magnificent ivory throne stood, a special palace for the daughter of Pharaoh, Solomon's most high-born wife, and living quarters for Solomon's multitude of wives and children. It seems odd, though, that in this list of all his building projects, he doesn't mention the biggest, most historically significant thing he built. It was the temple in Jerusalem. The account in 1 Kings tells us it took him 7 years to build that temple, yet it took him twice as long to build his own palace. The temple was built for the glory of God. The palace was built for the glory of Solomon. He had many servants. The rich always want somebody to do the hard work for them. In this case, they were slaves who couldn't even go on strike if they didn't like what was happening to them. Solomon had ranches to provide diversion and profit in his raising of his herds and his flocks. Many wealthy people today invest their money in ranches and the like. Bank accounts give a sense of security. So he had all the money he needed. It says that he had the net worth of provinces, not just kings and people, but whole provinces. He sought the pleasure of music. He had singers imported, and he sought the pleasure of sex. And boy, did he ever get it. The word concubine is literally means man. He uses the term man's delight, but he literally is someone who is there for sexual pleasure only. And scripture here, it just says he had many concubines, but in 1 Kings 11, it says he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Do you remember Jim and classic Huckleberry Finn? This is one of the reasons Jim couldn't believe in the Bible, because the Bible said that Solomon was the wisest man in the world, and he had 700 wives, and Jim could just never see how those two things fit together. This shows how wrong is the idea, though, of some people who say the Playboy mentality is kind of peculiar to the 20th century. It really wasn't there until, you know, Hugh Hefner brought it around. And yet King Solomon tried all of those things. David Zimmerman, author, said this: he used his wealth and influence to get anything that caught his eye. If he saw a beautiful woman, he added her to his harem. If he saw a thoroughbred that promised to be faster than other horses, it went into his stables. If he saw a new model chariot on the showroom floor, sleeker, racier, he would buy him.
Probably the showroom,
yeah. Then, just in case you're saying, yeah, but you probably didn't get any real satisfaction out of all those things, he then takes you to the fourth point in verse 9 and 10, and he gives you an assessment of how he did. Verse 9, so I became greater than all who had lived in Jerusalem before me, and my wisdom never failed me. Anything I wanted, I would take. I denied myself no pleasure. I even found great pleasure in hard work, a reward for all my labors. And then he draws his conclusion from it, and that's the fifth part, down in verse 11. Same conclusion he gave at the end of verse 1 and 2. Verse 11, but as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless, like chasing the wind. There was nothing really worthwhile anywhere. Now, before we go on, I want to pause and ask you, what does your pursuit of pleasure tell about you? Now, I don't think the pursuit of pleasure in and of itself is wrong. I really don't. There's a way to do it right and a way to do it wrong, however. But what does your pursuit of pleasure tell about you? Is your pursuit of pleasure an alternative to the pleasures that come from God? Or does it flow out of a contentment in the pleasures of God? Two different things. Well, how do we tell the difference between those two things? It's rather easy, actually. Does your leisure time, your vacation time, your extra time, does it have God in it? Or is God absent from your leisure time, your entertainment time, your vacation time? Why do you pursue your pleasure? Are you trying to kill some pain from the past? Is there some sense of lack that's driving your pursuit of pleasure? How about your entertainment? What's it like? Is it entertainment you can bring Jesus along to? The second thing we see is you must think hard about what the world is promising you in its pledge of pleasure. What is the lie of pleasure? This is it. What are the tricks that come along with the lies of pleasure? What are they? And how does pleasure cheat you? You know, we're told by sociologists that about 20,000 times a day now, we're hit with an image or an idea promising us pleasure in this world. Whether it's through print or radio or television or the internet, you're being promised 20,000 times a day in this world that it can provide you pleasure and satisfaction. So what's the lie? The lie is this, that earthly pleasure can provide you with true satisfaction. You just need to give it a chance. Just keep trying. You'll get it. That's what every commercial marketing venture is telling you. Just give it a chance. It will work. If you're not happy, you haven't given it a chance. It'll make you happy. Just do X or buy Y or just go to Z. It will give you satisfaction and pleasure. And what are the tricks that come along with that lie? When pleasure fails to satisfy, the world then says, well, no, if you can only get the right thing, then you'll be satisfied. You just haven't found the right thing. It's the next thing. That's what will do it. The other trick the world plays is you're not satisfied yet. It's because you don't have enough of that thing that you want. You just need more. More will do it. Just add more. Your buddy over there, he's got more and he's happy. If you had more, you'd be happy too. That's the other lie. Then, of course, there are those folks who are pretty satisfied with their pleasures right now. Frankly, they're not thinking about it very much. What trick does pleasure play in that situation? It says, look, stop thinking about all this stuff. Just enjoy it. And that kind of shallowness about life anesthetizes us to reality. You know, there's laws here that come into play. There's the law of unfulfilled expectations. You thought that getting the next thing would suffice, that you would get it. You thought that getting more would do it, and then it didn't. And then where do you go? Solomon's saying, don't think the next thing will do it. Don't think that more will do it. Because I had the next thing. I had the more, and it didn't do it. There's a law of diminishing returns. The things that you once craved and delighted in become boring after a while, and you crave even more. There's a law of unintended consequences. You're pursuing the pleasure, but along with that pleasure comes something you thought would never, ever happen. I didn't realize the pursuit of pleasure would cost me my family, my children. I didn't know the pursuit of pleasure would cost me my church or my job or my community. Pleasure is a liar and a trickster and a cheat, and yet we pursue it at all costs. Thirdly, the only pleasure that can ultimately fulfill us is pleasure in God. You know, the Christian solution, the Bible solution to hedonism and the pursuit of pleasure is not to renounce pleasure, not to say it's bad, but to seek our pleasure from God. The world thinks the Christian agenda is to make us as miserable as possible. And it looks it does that because the world hears us saying things like, die to yourself, deny yourself, take up your cross, die daily, consecrate yourself, give yourself away to God, climb on the altar, be a living sacrifice to God. And the world says, you know, that just doesn't sound like a lot of fun. And the world is half right there. Usually when you do these things, it's not fun. But we have to understand what the Bible's telling us. Galatians chapter 2, verse 20 says this, I have been crucified with Christ and I no longer live, but Christ now lives in me. Meaning is not found in the self-gratifying pursuit of earthly pleasure, but true pleasure is found in God and only God. So the Christian says to the pleasure seeker, your problem is not that you want too much, is that you're satisfied with too little. You'll take trinkets when God is offering you pounds and mounds of gold. The filet mignon dinner has been set before you. You say, no thanks, I think I'll go to Del Taco today. You're rejecting real, profound, lasting pleasure for fake and temporary pleasure. He goes on then to talk about the wise and the foolish. Verse 12, so I decided to compare wisdom with foolishness and madness, for who can do this better than I, the king thought? Wisdom is better than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness. For the wise can see where they're going, but fools walk in the dark. Yet I saw that the wise and the foolish share the same fate. Both will die. So I said to myself, since I will end up the same as the fool, what's the value of all my wisdom? This is also meaningless. For the wise and foolish both die. The wise will not be remembered any longer than the fool. In the days to come, both will be forgotten. So I came to hate life because everything done here under the sun is so troubling. Everything is meaningless, like chasing the wind. Even wisdom itself, and Jesus called him the wisest man who ever was and who ever will be. Even wisdom itself was not enough. You know, Dr. Haddon Robinson once recounted what it was like to stand at the gravesite of a man who had a working knowledge of 34 languages. Most of us feel pretty proud of ourselves if we got at least two languages, but he knew several dozen. And yet in the end, it didn't matter how smart he was still dead as he could be, no matter how many languages he knew. We see other examples of this. On June 9th, 1983, Eagle Computer, I don't know who was around in 1983, remember this, but Eagle Computer, IBM had its PC, but then the clones started coming. And by that I mean companies would make cheaper versions of the IBM product. And the first to do so successfully was Eagle Computer. It was introduced in 1982. And on June 8th, 1 year later, the day of Eagle's initial public offering, its president and founder, Dennis Barnhart, instantly instantly became a multi-millionaire. However, on that same day, just hours after that public offering, Barnhart was taking a yacht salesman to lunch and was killed in a crash in his brand new Ferrari. All of that wealth, all of that stuff that he was clamoring for, gone in an instant. Solomon says that he hates life. It's not that he wanted to commit suicide, it just life didn't present anything to him that he wanted. The atheist, Voltaire, put it this way, "I hate life, and yet I'm afraid to die." Now the preacher takes us from the contemplative life, the wisdom is the way of meaning, to the sensuous life, pleasure is the way of meaning, to the active life. Our work, our vocation, our activity, our causes, that meaning can be supplied for life. My work, it's important, it's successful, it's beneficial. Maybe I can find meaning in my life via my work. That's what many of us are saying. We find meaning in our lives through our work. Now, work is a wonderful thing. A work ethic is a wonderful thing. In fact, most of all, our work ethic comes from a Judeo-Christian ethic principle. But the evil one can even use good things against us. If we're trying to find meaning in our work alone, and if we're trying to find significance and satisfaction in our work alone, then the preacher is telling us we will not find it there. In fact, in this passage, he'll tell us three things about work. Number one, work, however fulfilling, cannot supply the answers to meaning and satisfaction apart from God. Verse 18, "I came to hate all my hard work here on earth, for I must leave to others everything I've earned. And who can tell whether my successors will be wise or foolish? Yet they'll control everything I have gained by my skill and hard work under the sun. How meaningless." See, at that very point, Solomon was concerned that his son Rehoboam would continue his legacy. But we know from the Bible that, in fact, he did not. Rehoboam did not follow the wisdom of his father. Instead, he rejected his father and he listened to foolish advisors. And his subsequent actions divided the kingdom of Israel right down the middle. At the height of his power, Rehoboam abandoned God. Egypt attacked Jerusalem, took away all the treasures of the temple and the palace that his father had brought in place. And Rehoboam was forced to pay an annual tribute to Egypt, and the glory of his father's reign became history, and only that. The preacher tells us that work will not work as the source of the provision of meaning and significance in life. He says, apart from God, work is drudgery and toil and emptiness. The word he uses for work here in verse 18 is a very broad term. It can mean our labor, the stuff we do as we think of work, but it could be our responsibilities or our pursuits, maybe our social reform issues or our politics. Solomon's not saying, I work my fingers to the bone and I get nothing for it. In fact, he's actually saying, look, I work my fingers to the bone. I enjoyed doing it. I liked doing what I did, and I made more money than you'll ever know. And still, I am totally empty. You see, the satisfaction one gets from one's work is not merely tied to the income you get from it. That can make it sweet, and it's nice to have it, but that's more not where he's had the most, and it didn't do it. Everything we had is to be left to a successor. Why is that? Because we all die. We leave something behind. So from one standpoint, none of us fully enjoy the fruits of our labors, and it's left to someone else who didn't work for it in the first place. Secondly, notice he says there's no guarantee that one's successor will be wise. He could be a fool, and he may misspend everything that you've worked so hard to earn. Many pursue work in politics or social reform because they think they can thereby make the world a better place, and that could be their legacy. But would Thomas Jefferson recognize the Democratic Party today? Would Abraham Lincoln recognize the Republican Party today if they were alive? Your successors can change everything, and the preacher is thinking all about that. Verse 20, "So I gave up in despair, questioning the value of all my hard work in this world." What a dismal way of looking at it, and in total contrast to what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. "So my dear brothers and sisters, be strong and immovable. Always work enthusiastically for the Lord, for you know that nothing you do for the Lord is ever useless." The third thing here, and the final thing for this passage, there's only despair in all the work that's done under the sun, or that is apart from God. 21, "Some people work wisely with knowledge and skill, and they must leave the fruit of their efforts to someone who hasn't worked for it. This too is meaningless, a great tragedy." So what do people get in this life for all their hard work, all their anxiety? Their days of labor are filled with pain and grief. Even at night, their minds cannot rest. It's all meaningless. I'm going to give all this to somebody who hasn't toiled for it. How will they manage? He's pointing out that work plus success minus God equals meaning. He's pointing out that work plus success plus all the money in the world minus God is meaningless. Work is not the way to find meaning. Have you ever seen an inheritance, for instance, break up a family? I haven't. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Have you seen an inheritance go to an outsider? Have you seen an inheritance ruin children for the rest of their lives? These are just examples of the kind of futilities the preacher is talking about here. Is there no answer? Is it all hopelessness? Well, in the last three verses here, which we follow, we'll have the first statement of the true message of this book of Ecclesiastes. After all this depressing talk, we get some positive. It's just a matter of time before we're all too jaded, burned out. Life has lost all its value and meaning and color for us. And the preacher says this, put a relationship with God into that picture and everything changes. The only way to know, number three, the blessed labor is to receive the blessing of God. Verse 24, so I decided there's nothing better than to enjoy food and drink and to find satisfaction in my work. And then I realized that these pleasures are from the hand of God. For who can eat or enjoy anything apart from him? This is actually the first time the preacher mentions God, all the way some 25 verses into chapter 2, right? And then he says something very dark and disturbing in verse 26. God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy to those who please him. But if a sinner becomes wealthy, God takes the wealth away and gives it to those who please him. This too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. This is the first of six conclusions that Solomon makes in the book of Ecclesiastes. Not only were the blessings from God, but even the enjoyment of the blessings from God were his gift to us. The sinner has been given by God the task of gathering and collecting so he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. It reminds me of something Jesus said, Matthew chapter 13, verse 12. To those who listen to my teaching, more understanding will be given, and they'll have an abundance of knowledge. But for those who are not listening, even what little understanding they have will be taken away from them. In other words, apart from God, it's not just that those in God will have more, and those not in God will have less, but that those who are in God, trusting in God, through Jesus Christ, will have all, and those who are not will have nothing. Now, Fanny Crosby, you may have heard of Fanny Crosby, one of the favorite hymn writers of all time. She was blind almost from birth. She lived to be 95 years old, wrote many of the great hymns that we know today. When she was only 8 years old, she wrote this, "Oh, what a happy child I am, although I cannot see. I am resolved in this world, contented I will be. How many blessings I enjoy that other people don't. To weep and sigh because I'm blind, I cannot, and I won't." So here's the trick that Ms. Crosby and others discovered so early in their life. You can't find pleasure under the sun. You can only find it in the sun. You can't find wisdom under the sun. You can only find it in the sun. You can't find true meaning under the sun. You can only find it in the sun. And you can't find true purpose under the sun. We can only find it in the sun. Let us pray.